Inside Lane podcast. I'm here with Dr. Ross Tucker, who's been with us throughout the week, and it has been a very interesting week, but probably today one of the most dramatic instances and dramas of the World Championships happened last night. We've just before we came online, we were watching the interview that Wade van Niekerk did with the BBC. We got really emotional at the finish, and we'll explain a bit about why that happened in the next couple of minutes. And then we'll talk a little bit about the progression of records, why the times have been pretty slow over the last of the 100, the 200, the 400, even the hurdles during these World Championships. And we're going to throw a couple of hypotheses towards that as well. And then we'll talk a little bit about the finals tonight, the women's 200 meters. That's going to be the big one to watch. But there is so much to talk about. We're going to try and get through reasonably quickly. But it's probably one of the most dramatic. I can't remember World Championships that had this much drawn around a single event, and that was the 200 meters. So just to give you some background, if you haven't seen it all over, if you're interested in the World Champs, you've probably seen it already. Isaac Mokwala, who gets sick earlier in the week, he ends up with a gastrovirus. He gets quarantined for 48 hours. He's not labeled to run the 400 meters, his favorite event, because the doctors say that he's contagious. He then can't run the heats for the 200 meters as well. And then he eventually runs a time trial by himself. I think it was on Thursday night. Oh, sorry, Wednesday night. Wednesday night. And then he does the semi-finals on Wednesday night. And then, of course, last night we had the final of the 200 meters up against the South African Wade van Niekerk, who's the record holder in the 400 meters and the Olympic champion, going for the double gold. What happens last night? Wade van Niekerk doesn't win. He narrowly misses out on the gold medal to the Turkey athlete Ramil Guliyev. Finishes in second place ahead of Doreen Richards. Mokwala's nowhere. But the interview afterwards was very telling, because there has been a suggestion by the great Michael Johnson, and I'm struggling to say great at the moment because I feel quite strongly about this. Michael Johnson tweets and even is interviewed on the BBC suggesting that there's some kind of conspiracy theory that the IAAF have left out Mokwala from the 400 and the 200 because they want to give Wade van Niekerk, the golden child of world athletics, the chance to win the double gold. I think it's outrageous that he said that, and I think he's created something, a stir around something that should not have been started. Ross?
Yeah, I agree. Just in the interest of disclosure, Mike, I have a slight stomach bug and also a head cold, so that's why I sound like this today for all the listeners, and I didn't tell you that because I was worried that you'd quarantine me and then I'd have to come back on Monday and do this by myself. If we were in the nanny state of London, Mike would be here presenting this by himself today. So Michael Johnson's a pundit on the BBC, and those guys had a field day on Wednesday with the whole Mokwala thing. You would have seen, perhaps, watching this footage of Mokwala arriving at the warm-up area and getting turned away. It was, the BBC were loving it, maybe because it distracted from doping and Gatlin and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But they've come in for a lot of criticism for the way they covered it, including the possibility that the IAAF will make a formal complaint because of an interview they did with the medical director of the London Championships. Mm-hmm. I think that's absurd. I mean, grow up.
Yeah.
Of course,
obviously want to control the narrative at every point.
Of course, the media will probe and interrogate and have an agenda. And I think actually the medical director came off well in that interview. So the IAAF should thank the BBC for being so obtuse about that particular issue. But this one with Johnson is, I don't know whether that's the sort of thing where Johnson's walking up the stairs to the studio and someone says to him, like, MJ, don't you think this is a conspiracy? And then he doesn't think it through and he sits there in the studio and he's playing devil's advocate, or he's sort of nominating himself to be the messenger. But because he's Michael Johnson and he's recognized as this credible voice, it's a big claim to make.
He tweets it and also gets interviewed as well. It's not an ad hoc thing. He does it.
Yeah, so he's stoking it, you know. And I mean, we all love a good conspiracy, you know.
Yeah.
But I find it preposterous to think that you would manipulate an event like that. Mm. I mean, there's other ways you could do it, but you wouldn't. You wouldn't manipulate the event by causing such a drama in front of the whole world, and then it's unfortunate because it's detracted from not just Wade van Niekerk. I mean, we watched that video. You can find it on the BBC of him. He's unable to speak because he's overcome with emotion, and it takes them about a minute to get him back onto the camera.
You can also check Runners World South Africa's Twitter feed. We've also retweeted it from there as well.
Posted today. So
mention that.
So I. it's unfortunate because I think it affected Mukwala. It's obviously affected Wade Phinikak now.
Mm.
It affects their relationships moving forward.
Mm.
And in one regard, it's quite spicy and it's brought out a bit of emotion that is not always a bad thing.
Mm.
But it would be nice to sit here and talk about a super tight 200 meter finish, but instead we talk about all this. It's just,
yeah.
And again, point I made yesterday on this podcast in response to the same topic is that Michael Johnson throwing that out there and that accusation of a conspiracy gaining credibility, that doesn't happen with good governance.
Yeah.
Like it needs this, it's almost like the soil has to be fertile enough for that to take hold.
Mm.
And the reason the soil is that fertile is because when you stop an athlete from running based on the way that it was done, it was just poor governance because it looked arbitrary.
Mm.
And that's the big problem because some athletes competed hours after collapsing. Other athletes weren't allowed, even though they... So it looks arbitrary, and that invites conspiracy theories. Yeah. And so everyone has got some responsibility for the mess, but it's just a pity for the athletes. Because I feel for Mukwala, I feel for everyone. It's just
I mean, he had to, I mean, Wade Phinikak last night, if you watched this clip, and we just literally watched it a few moments ago, and he is absolutely distraught with emotion because he feels that he's put in the time. He's always operated, and if you know Wade Phinikak, a very devout, religious guy who plays, you know, very above board, suddenly he's being accused of being part of a conspiracy that he's potentially not even involved in, which takes away from his victory in the 400. It also takes away potentially from his silver medal because there's some sort of idea that Mukwala had a tougher road to get there. So everything that he's worked for Wade Phinikak is now being questioned by somebody who has no evidence. And I think that's the sadness of this, is that Wade Phinikak isn't being given the due respect that he should have been given because of the suggestion that there's some sort of conspiracy.
Yeah, and that's why when you make decisions about excluding a guy for... Even if Mukwala had norovirus, and we still don't know, because and we never will, because he was never tested for it. It was a symptom assessment, and then because he had symptoms that were in common with others who did, they grouped him with that. But the point I try to make when it happened is, even if you go worst case and he's got this, you should still figure out whether there's a way to let him compete so that you don't open the door to this kind of thing happening. To me, sports organizations should look to enable competition and positive stories, not shut them down. So people on, again, Twitter, it's a public health issue and so on. Yes, it is, but it's also a sporting issue. And if you give it to medical experts, and then you potentially ignore the consequences of those actions, because they do have real world consequences, and that interview is one of them.
Yeah.
The fact that Mukwala doesn't have a single medal in either the two or the four might be another one.
Mm.
I mean, who's to say he would have won a medal in the four anyway? He never has.
Mm.
So it's not as though they took out a guy who was going to beat Phinikak.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think he would have won that anyway.
Yeah.
So they didn't need to protect.
Although
Wade
we were
in the
saying at one point he might have been the favorite just because he had this sort of drive in the two. Yeah.
But in the four, Mukwala was never the favorite. Like Phinikak was winning that race 99 days out of 100.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why would you risk such reputational damage to protect a long shot? To protect an almost sure thing.
Yeah.
It's just silly.
Well, that's our view of it. So if you want to let us know how you feel about the Michael Johnson comments and the theories around that he's been espousing, let us know. And we would love to hear what everybody thinks. Let's just talk a little bit about that 200-meter final last night. The winner was the Turkish actor Ramil Guliyev. We were talking about him. He had a great semi-final. He ran it brilliantly. He obviously just edged out Wade Phinikak. But I guess, to some extent, Phinikak was a surprise, because when we were talking yesterday, he had such a poor semi-final that we were talking maybe he won't even get a medal.
Yeah, he came into London the guy to beat. He came into the final the guy not to beat.
Yeah.
So the question is, why is his semi-final so poor? Is it fatigue from the 400s? Is it the cold weather? If it's the fatigue, that's not going to go away between Wednesday and Thursday. So he still would have had that. But he was able to improve enough from the semi to the final, and no one else was. So when we previewed this yesterday, we said that Guliyev is the guy who is going to run between 19.9 and 20.1 every single time. He's almost the barometer.
Mm.
And in a higher quality race, he doesn't win a medal.
Mm.
in a lower quality, and I realize this sounds uncharitable, but that race yesterday is the slowest 200 since 2005. Mm. The first time no one has broken 20 seconds in that period. And I was amazed that you could win a global 200 in over 20 seconds. It's crazy. So yeah. To some extent, he is the beneficiary of what's a slow year. Because I think Fenech is worth a mid-19, and Mukwala's already run 19.7, and nobody even came close to that. So, yeah, that race looked like this, in that there were 9 guys who could have medaled, and 5 guys could have won it. Mm. And in the end, I was surprised it was slow. Mm.
Yeah. What's interesting is that we've seen generally slow times across the sprints throughout these world championships. I may be hypothesizing a little bit here, but when I looked at the field of the 200 meters last night, and I think back to the days when we had the big bulky sprinters, it seems like the athletes doing the sprints now are, I can't say more athletic, but they're leaner. They don't look as bulked up. Is there a suggestion that maybe we look at the guys, obviously Bolt has never been associated with anything in terms of doping, but Johan Black has, Gay has. We've seen a lot of this. Gatlin obviously has. Mm. Do you think potentially there is an argument to suggest that the war on drugs is being won at an international level, and therefore these are the performances that you would expect? I mean, clearly Wade van Niekerk was tired, and that would be normal for that situation. But if he was potentially doped up, he wouldn't be as tired. Yeah. So, do you think there's a general sense that the war on drugs globally is being won to some extent?
It depends, I think, on how you define one. Does it mean that they've stopped doping? Definitely not. No way. In the last 8 or 9 years, I've looked a lot at cycling. Right, this is excuse me for deviating sports, but one of the things that not only me but a number of people have done is let's look at performances in cycling, and the basis for that is that if anti-doping is improving, performances will get slower. Okay. Now, when we are skeptical about performances, whether it's in track and field or cycling, a big part of the reason for that is that the performances are getting faster and faster and faster and better. So it would make me a hypocrite here to sit here now and say that the fact that performances are getting slower has nothing to do with doping. Because when performances get better, people say, oh, doping.
Yeah.
So therefore, the opposite must be true, right? Mm. So it could be. It could be true. And as I say, it would make me a hypocrite to say no chance. So there is a possibility that that's happened. And I remember about 3 years ago when the increased scrutiny came onto Kenya, because Kenya for years has had non-existent anti-doping. They just don't have the capacity to test in Kenya. And when that began to change, I remember hypothesizing and saying this, is that it will be interesting to look at the next 5 to 10 years. The theory being that as the scrutiny on Kenya increases, the times will get slower.
Yeah,
I think that has happened, but it doesn't mean it's been won. Mm. But it means that when you look at something, you can change its behavior, right? So it is. Anyway, long story short, it's enticing now to speculate that the slower times that we're seeing is some evidence of better anti-doping, and it could be that. The implication of that, of course, is that what we saw before was doped, and that's where it gets tricky.
Because there's always the suggestion that there are athletes. I remember talking to somebody a few years back who was involved in athletics, saying that it's not the very best, it's not the Bolts that are the problem, because they are the outliers to some extent, and they are performing. But it's the fourth, fifth, sixth guys who want to become third, second, first, and that are potentially thinking they need that little bit of extra advantage. And if you look at the evidence, Blake, Gay, and Gatlin, they were all in that sort of bracket, not quite at the top of their game, not quite able to be Bolt, but sitting under, and maybe potentially the temptation was too much.
Yeah, the thing about outliers is that you have to remember that everyone in the world champs in the top 20 is already an outlier. So to be an outlier, you've got to be an outlier among outliers, you know?
Yeah.
And we brought this up before. I'm not a fan of the outlier theory. As long as the sport is deep enough and exposed to enough people, I think that the natural gaps between people should be quite small.
Yeah.
So it is possible. Again, you can't discount the possibility that some athletes and some performances are just normal, natural, clean outliers. So yes, that could happen. But I tend to think more often than not those gaps are created by non-legal means than just natural variation.
Well, we'll be watching the performances. I think the next 18 months in athletics will be interesting because at the moment there's a movie doing the circuit to Icarus, which is a little bit about the very interesting. If you want to watch it on Netflix, there's lots of places you can watch it. But it's an interesting look at the Russian doping system, which was very systematic. And you know, there are obviously some objective side of that thing that you need to look at. It's a one-sided view of something, but it does raise the question about very systematic doping that's been happening at national level in countries like Russia.
Yeah.
So have a look at it. It's a fascinating documentary.
Yeah, just on that, sorry, can I just... If you watch, it's on Netflix at the moment. That's, I assume, where you've watched it.
Yeah.
We're
not paid by Netflix to say that, by the way.
the guy started making the movie because he's a very good amateur cyclist.
Mm.
And he wants to dope in this big amateur race in France, and he wants to get help to avoid failing the drug tests.
Mm.
We never really see the end of that particular story, and it's left a little bit hanging, which is the one aspect of the movie I was disappointed in. Because in the process of doing the doping, he meets the guy who turns out to have been the head of the systematic Russian doping program.
Mm.
So the whole story goes from here to there.
Yeah.
Zigzags.
Yeah.
Completely.
I haven't finished watching it yet. So no spoilers.
But for me, the most interesting thing in the whole movie is right at the beginning, this cyclist, Brian Fogel, starts off working with a guy called Don Catlin. And Don Catlin is kind of recognized as one of the fathers of anti-doping.
Mm.
He's a scientist in the United States, one of the most respected figures. And he makes a couple of statements that for me are the most profound in the movie. And he's asked by Fogel, is anti-doping effective? How many athletes are doping? He says, anti-doping is ineffective and they're all doping. Now, that to me is eye-opening. Look, fine, the Russians are doping, but when the credible voice in the West has that opinion of anti-doping, then you know you're in trouble. And so that's honestly, that's the most interesting thing, and I wish he'd pursued that more instead of getting stuck on Russia, because just like Justin Gatlin is almost a shield or a safety net for the 100-meter guys, Russia's a safety net for sports doping worldwide.
Yeah.
It's easy to blame them and think everyone else is fine.
Yeah. Well, I think if you love athletics and you love sport of any kind, you want to make sure that you want the war on drugs to be beaten, and we know it's always a tough one. So we'll see in the next 18 months what happens. One of the subjects that was discussed, I think we've got a question on our Facebook live feed.
Sorry to interrupt you, but Glynis is a regular, so this is a third or fourth question. Thank you for listening, Glynis. She's asked, excuse my ignorance, but what do you mean by outlier? The commentators on BBC use it all the time. Like, how do you understand outlier?
I guess what you were talking about earlier. It's the guy that, like Bolt, to some extent. Here comes a guy who's so dominant over everybody else that you think, well, is that person just incredibly gifted? Has he been genetically gifted beyond anybody else? That's how I understand it.
Yeah, for me, imagine, Glynis, that you were to take 100 12-year-old kids at a school and you line them up. And everyone ranges between 1.5 meters and 1.7 meters.
Mm.
But right at the end is a kid who's 194 at the age of 12.
Yeah.
That's an outlier for height. He's naturally just stands apart from his peers.
Mm.
Except instead of height, we're talking performance. That's what an outlier is.
So they have been greats. And you know, in cycling, we talked about those kind of guys. I think people thought Lance Armstrong was an outlier.
Exactly.
But it proved he wasn't. You know?
Mm. Marion Jones was an outlier. So that's the problem, is when we see extraordinary performances, people who elevate themselves well beyond the population, is it natural or is it illegal? And and because of the last 20 years, pattern recognition has taught us that it's probably illegal.
Yeah.
Because it was illegal for Lance. Marion Jones was illegal. Tim Montgomery was a dope, and so on and so on. So it's pattern recognition is what is driving people's suspicions.
I want to believe in outliers.
So everyone does. That's why we watch. We want to believe that Wade's an outlier and that Rhodesia was an outlier in London. But exposure to the sport gives you patterns that you start to question, and that's
Okay, let's move on. One of the interesting facets, and obviously this is a very South African story, we looked at the medal standings last night. South Africa third on the medal table. Yeah. And I can tell you that, you know, if anybody who knows about athletics here in South Africa will tell you that the Federation has been under attack virtually, you know, for the last 5 years, and particularly recently around some of their selections. You know, the Athletics Federation in South Africa, probably not one of the best in the world, if I can understate that. But yet, incredible to see South Africa third overall after 7 days of competition, behind the US and Kenya. Obviously, the gaps are quite big between those countries, but it seems those smaller nations like South Africa are getting a foothold, and we would never have imagined that maybe a year ago, even going into these World Championships, I wouldn't have thought of South Africa sitting on the table in the podium position.
Yeah, although a week ago we could have forecast four golds. Yeah. It seems now we'll get three, because Wade was certainly a pick for gold, and he's the silver now. So we should, I mean, fatigue notwithstanding, Semenya should win the 800. Mm. And then we won three, and three other minor ones, which is six in total. It's a big haul. And so there's questions around, and people have asked me, journalists, like, what's going on in South Africa? Mm. Is it suspicious? Is it not? Now, we don't know.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not central. No. In the sense that it's not coordinated. It's not as though there's somebody that said, there is a strategic plan to improve South African track and field over 10 years. There's no plan here, folks. So whatever is happening is happening here and here and here and here. It's not happening in...
It's basically the opposite of the Russian Federation, that nothing's coordinated.
Right, now that doesn't mean that there's not some stuff going on. And I'm quick to point out, in 2012, we had 10 athletes fail drug tests that year, track and field.
Yeah.
Track and field.
Yeah.
And many of our top sprinters, our first guy ever under 10, refused to take a test and caught himself a 2-year ban. So you can never exclude that possibility. Yeah. But
I'm trying to ignore that possibility.
It's definitely not... it's not centralized. And on that, you know, the medal table, we're now ahead of Great Britain.
Yeah.
And what they've discovered is the same thing that we are very experienced at. So I completely sympathize with you over there. Mm. Is that when you have these good years, you can be deceived into thinking everything is healthy because of a couple of athletes.
Yeah.
And for many years, Great Britain was carried by Mo Farah, winning two at every World Champs and Olympics. Jess Ennis was winning pretty much on demand, and they had Christina Harugu, so they were winning gold, but it was three athletes. And then once the life of those three athletes is over, suddenly now the well is dry. And we've had that problem in this country, is that there's no next level planning, you know. So hopefully that doesn't happen and we kick on. I mean, if I was in charge of SA Track and Field, if any of you are listening to this, which I highly doubt, because they already know everything at ASA. I would be bidding to host the World Champs in 2023 in South Africa.
Yeah.
Because then what you're doing is you're saying, current good generation, let's give the next one even more reason to follow up. And that's how you leverage success.
And it creates heroes, I guess, which is the best form of development.
Heroes and aspiration, that's what you need. And then as long as you've got opportunity for them, then you're winning. That's why success breeds success. But only if you match it up with opportunity.
ASA, I hope you're listening. We doubt it, but we hope you're listening. Let's talk a little bit about tonight. In fact, before we go on there, we were having a bit of a... I can't say we were having a go, but we were talking about the triple jump before we went on air. And we were talking about... I looked it up last night. I was trying to work out why is the triple jump, and what is the origins of the triple jump? We watched the final last night. It was a great final. I mean, it's certainly quite exciting, and they're a charismatic lot, the triple jumpers, but... I can never understand it. You know, I always think athletics is a bit about faster, higher, stronger. And suddenly there's an event where you have to take two hops and a skip and a couple of jumps, and suddenly you're in a pit. And I thought, well, where does that come from? Why did it have to be that format? And it seems almost a bit silly, the triple jump, in some respects, that it had survived. And it was first brought in the Olympics in 1896. So it's been around for a long time. But I struggle to understand. It almost feels like the B race of the long jump.
Well,
is that fair? Argue, I mean, with all apologies to triple jumpers out there,
you could argue that the long jump is the little cousin of the triple jump, because they're going 18 meters, right? Long jumpers make seven.
True.
Well, in the women's it'll be seven. That's tonight, by the way, women's long jump, and the men are jumping in the mid eights. So you could argue that it's the other way around, and the athletic challenge of the triple jump to be strong off both legs, to control balance at speed, and it. They're impressive athletes.
That's a good point,
they really are impressive athletes. And I don't have the explosiveness to do it, but I remember coaching a guy at school who was a triple jumper, and they're quite phenomenal athletes, still rubber balls, actually.
That's a good point, actually. So, that it is a particular skill, and I know that the original, there was at one point early in the history of the Olympics, there was the standing triple jump, and there was a standing long jump, where you didn't have a run-up, you just had to jump as far as you could and triple jump. So it was much like hopscotch.
Yeah.
And we've, you know, I'm sure we didn't play hopscotch when we were at school, but many people did.
Mm.
But so the originalities of it are there.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, it isn't long jump. There is a certain level of expertise needed to do that event.
Yeah.
I always battled to kind of get my head around it a bit.
I mean, it is spectacular to watch. You've seen it live.
Yeah, true.
Like when you watch, and you spoke the other night about showing your son, I think he's 17, 18,
yes.
what an 8.50 meter jump looks like.
Yeah.
And it's eye-popping. And triple jumps actually even more amazing.
Yeah.
And, so one thing
18,
I've been...
What's the distance? 18 meters?
Well, 18, 20 odd is the... So that's impressive.
That's a long
right?
way in three jumps.
It's big.
Yeah.
And so what they've been doing in London, which I've quite enjoyed, is they've been breaking it down. Have you seen that in the triple jump? They'll pull up, Taylor wins it in 1768, and his first step, the hop, is 6.50 or whatever it is, and then the middle one is 4.88, and the last one's 6.08. That's quite cool to see as well, because...
Yeah.
You see where they and how they have to control their movement, and if your first one's too big, you lose momentum. You can't.
Yes.
So it's a.
I think it looks a bit. Looks a bit like human skipping stones.
Yeah, and that's they are. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's. I'm glad you give
that
a bit.
And
I feel better,
by the way. While we're talking jumps, next week in France they are having a special competition in the high altitudes, and by high we're talking 3,030 meters above sea level.
Where is this?
I think it's at a French ski resort. No, well, that'll be Italy, but I think teams or something. I didn't catch the name of the place, but they're having a customized long and triple jump with the intention of breaking the world records.
Yeah.
And the reason that would help is because altitude means thin air, and thin air means less resistance to overcome in the jump. So in theory, they will have an advantage that might... It's almost like the equivalent of that sub-2-hour marathon.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of similarities.
And so Taylor, who won last night, will be there, and Manyonga, who won the long jump a few days back, will be there in competitions with the intention. So keep an eye out for that. Those jumps will always have an asterisk next to them.
What's the world record on the long jump?
8.95 by Powell.
Okay.
Yeah, so when Bob Beamon jumped 8.90, that was the... one of the iconic sports moments.
Yeah.
That was no doubt assisted in Mexico by the altitude.
So Manyonga maybe, I know you said he wanted to go over 9 meters.
So that might, I'd be surprised.
Yeah.
I don't know, I think altitude is going to help, but I don't know if it's going to help him to the tune of 40, 50 centimeters.
Do you know what it's worth? Any way of measuring the high altitude versus the coastal jump? I mean...
You can do it for 100, but I've never seen it for seen it for long jump. I'm sure it exists. We'll look it up.
I'll come back tomorrow and let us know what you think.
Yeah.
Right, just a quick preview of tonight's final. There's a couple of finals tonight, but the one that everybody's talking about is obviously the women's 200 meters. Interesting last night, and this is another story that we can't really get our heads around. Shauna Emele-Wiebo, who was the Olympic champion in the 400 meters. As she finishes the 400 meters with a clear lead over the rest of the field, she ties up towards the end and she gets stretchered off and finishes, I think she was fourth or fifth in the end. Doesn't get a medal.
Yeah.
Nobody knows why. Porter Radcliffe goes on to Twitter and says, no, she had a problem with her quad muscle. There's all sorts of theories going around. Eventually, after the semifinals of the women's 200 last night, she says, no, she got distracted by looking at the screen and lost her balance. Ross has watched the replay 3 million times. What? How does that sound? It's a weird excuse, I think.
She says she looked up at the screen and then as she did that, she lost her balance. I find it difficult to believe that an elite athlete who's so accustomed to running would do that. I mean, it sounds like something I would do.
Mm.
Not an elite, highly connected, highly skilled athlete, you know?
Mm.
So I watched the replay and to me, what it looks like is that at some point, with about 30 meters to go, she loses the ability to either lift her heel off the ground or to drive her leg. We don't know which it is.
Mm.
And as a consequence of that, she's basically like, and I don't know if this can even be in frame, but she can't lift this heel up.
Yes.
And so now she's dragging a lame left leg behind her.
Yes.
And then she clips the ground with her toe.
Yeah.
But to me, it looked like the problem happened, and then she clipped the ground, not the other way around.
So why?
But
why,
I don't know. I mean,
why would she say that? I mean, I find it interesting that she's explained it this way.
Yeah.
Why would she not say, look, I just tied up at the end?
Because I think probably from her perspective, the way she's feeling, that's what it felt like, is that I stumbled as I looked up. But to me, there was something happening before that that caused her to stumble. Again, why would such a skillful athlete, and you think running doesn't take skill, but when you look at these elite athletes, they don't move like normal humans do. They've got, they've actually got movement skill to run fast. And one of the big challenges of being a sprinter is coordination. I would look like a fish flopping on the deck of a boat at that sort of speed. They look smooth.
Yeah.
Miller looked smooth until, in my opinion, there was some muscle fatigue, some muscle cramping perhaps that happened. That then causes her to lose the coordination. And then maybe she looks up and trips.
Yeah.
So in her mind, that's what it felt like. Yeah. But it doesn't match the sequence I saw. Yeah. But what do we know?
Yeah. I suppose the lesson is don't look up at the big screen until you finish the race.
Yeah, just, I mean, it's a 400-meter sprint. You're not managing.
Maybe she just wanted to see her glory moment as it was happening up
maybe.
In the big stage.
I mean, at that stage, you're just hanging on for dear life and praying for the finish line.
Yeah. So watch it. If you want to, I mean, I'm sure it's all over the YouTube, but watch it. And let us know what you think. I mean, I think we discussed it a bit on WhatsApp last night.
Yeah. Whatever it is, it's not an injury. Because
you don't
get injured on the night before. And then come back in 23 hours and run a 20.5,
and she's
easy 200. Right? It's not an injury. To me, it's an acute failure or fatigue issue, which we spoke about yesterday on this podcast, which then might have caused loss of coordination, and then, as she said, I just stumbled. Yeah.
Last comment. The women's 200. Is she the one to watch?
So the women's 200 is interesting because the men's race was flat.
Yeah.
Anyone could have won it. Well, any one of the eight could have got a medal, and one of four or five could have won it. In the women's 300, there's three medalists, and unless something majorly goes wrong, those three women are getting the medal. So that would be Skippers of the Netherlands, Talou of Ivory Coast, who was silver in the 100, and Miller Weber, and they won their heats yesterday, all three very comfortably. So that's why I'm saying that's where the medals are going. But your guess is as good as mine as to who gets them. Skippers has the big champs experience at 200, so I would lean slightly towards her. Miller has the 400 meter strength, and on that, I mean, I totally messed the call up yesterday, but if you had paused that men's 200 with 90 to go, you're thinking Wade McQuala, because they were there. And in a 200 meter race, the two guys with the 400 meter strength normally finish faster. So with 90 to go, I thought Wade's got this because he was there. In the end, they didn't. Maybe that's fatigue. But in this women's 200, if Miller is there with 80 to go, she's winning.
Well, I'm going to call it. I'm going to call it Miller first. I'm going to go second for the Talou, and I'm going to go Skippers for the third.
So. I'd like Talou to win it.
And
she should have won the 100, in my opinion. She didn't lean, and it would be nice to see an Ivorian medal. I think that would be cool because. It's so diverse then. You've got a Turk, Ivorian, a couple of Americans, Jamaicans. So it's the medals are being spread out. It's good.
Yeah. Okay, so watch that tonight. We'll be back tomorrow for day number 9 in a couple more days.
Sorry.
Last one.
There's so much we leave on the table. Women's women's steeplechase, one of the best events of these champs.
That's tonight. Final.
Yeah. Four women, all capable of going under 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. They're aggressive races. If you've watched Diamond League races, you don't see games in the women's team. They go for it. And so I think that will be hell of a good. There's three Kenyans and a Kenyan now running for Bahrain, who's the world record holder and Olympic champ, but only fourth in the world. I mean, she was unbeatable last year. Now she's fourth because that event is in such constant flux.
It's a relatively new event, isn't it?
It's a new event. And it's finally, I think, gotten out of childhood and into puberty/adolescence, and it's really good. And so that will be a top race. Those three Kenyans against the Bahraini, formerly Kenyan, it'll be aggressive, and maybe Coburn can pick up if there's damage from the attacks at the front. She might pick it up, but look for that. That'll be fun.
Okay, so lots to look forward to tonight. We'll be back tomorrow at probably about 11 o'clock tomorrow with our podcast. We'll let you know as soon as we're up online. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Runners World South Africa. And, of course, Ross is a Science of Sport. He's his Twitter handle. So let us know what you think. Give us your opinion about some of the things we talked about today. There's been no shortage of things to talk about this week. We're going to be back tomorrow, Sunday, and we're going to wrap up on Monday morning as well. So stay tuned. Cheers for now.